Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are going to be tearing down the walls of the digital world to look at privacy. And we aren't just talking about it as some abstract, dusty legal concept. We are going to trace it from how you actually experience it in your daily life, all the way down to how software engineers are desperately trying to code your right to be left alone into the algorithms we use every day.
Right.
So we're pulling our foundation today from excerpts of an ethics workshop lecture. It's titled 4.5 Protecting Privacy Today. Think of this as a high-level exploration of attention that affects you constantly. We're looking at how a deeply human feeling is forcefully quantified and managed by machines.
It really is a profound structural tension. On one side, you have this incredibly visceral human reaction to being watched, and then on the other, you have the cold binary reality of artificial intelligence and systems engineering attempting to translate that human feeling into a rigid set of rules.
Which is incredibly hard to do.
Almost impossible. But to truly grasp the stakes here, we have to start with that visceral feeling, what you might call the phenomenological root of privacy. I want you to imagine sitting in your living room right now. You are completely alone, maybe reading a book or just staring at your phone. Now imagine a camera sitting right there in the corner, and you know it is watching every single thing you do.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because just the thought of that makes my skin crawl. It's tracking when I stand up, what I'm eating, how long I pause to look at a specific image on a screen.
Exactly.
And then instantly serving me targeted advertisements based on those hyper-specific mundane behaviors.
Precisely. That deeply unsettling feeling, that immediate invasion of your intimate space, that is the modern experience of a privacy violation.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like a physical intrusion, even though it's entirely digital.
Yeah, it's a very bodily reaction.
It is. But the theory of privacy goes much deeper than just that feeling of exposure. When we move into the formal philosophy of it, we realize that privacy is not merely the act of hiding. It isn't just locking yourself in a dark room and pulling the blinds down.
Right, because if it were just about hiding, then, hermits would be the only people with true privacy.
Yeah.
So how do we actually define it theoretically?
The formal definition centers on agency. Privacy is defined as the ultimate control over who has access to your personally identifying information. You are the architect of your own boundaries. You decide exactly who gets to know what about you, and crucially, in what context.
Which brings up a really fascinating paradox when you apply that definition of control to people in the public eye.
Oh, the celebrity paradox.
Yes, exactly. Think about Kim Kardashian for a second. Most people would look at her and say she has zero privacy because her entire life seems to be broadcast to the world on television and social media. But philosophically speaking, under this specific definition of control and agency,
she's actually a master of privacy.
Right.
It sounds incredibly counterintuitive, doesn't it? The public has access to an immense volume of information about her. But the critical distinction is that she meticulously controls the narrative and the data flow. The illusion is total exposure, but the reality is unmitigated control over what specific information is made accessible.
She acts as the gatekeeper.
Exactly. She determines the access, which makes her privacy architecture incredibly robust, even if it looks entirely transparent from the outside.
Okay, that makes sense for a celebrity managing a massive media empire. But what does that look like for the rest of us?
The lecture brings up a thought experiment that I think perfectly captures this tension. It's called the glass apartment dilemma.
That's a great analogy. Imagine you buy a brand new apartment, but every single external wall is made entirely of clear glass. You purchase this transparent box, you move your couch and your TV in, and you just live your life. Now, I'd argue it's a total nightmare for keeping the place clean, but ethically speaking, it's a disaster. Does the mere act of purchasing and living in that transparent space mean you have explicitly consented to people on the street looking in?
That is the crucial question. If a stranger stops on the sidewalk and just stands there staring through the glass while you eat dinner, is that a fundamental violation of your privacy? You bought the glass box. You knew it was transparent.
I mean, I feel like most people would still call the cops on that guy. Just because I have a window doesn't mean you get to press your face against it.
And that architectural dilemma perfectly characterizes our current relationship with social media and the internet at large. The internet is the glass apartment. We willingly sign up for these platforms. We voluntarily move into the glass box to connect with our friends. And we know on some level that we are allowing companies to look in. We leave the blinds open.
But the exact boundaries of what is being allowed, and crucially why it is being allowed, remain dangerously unclear. I mean, you might consent to a friend glancing at your glass apartment as they walk by to see if you're home, but you certainly didn't consent to a massive corporation setting up a tripod, recording your daily routines in 4K, and selling that behavioral data to an insurance company or a political advertiser.
Exactly. The context of the observation matters just as much as the observation itself. Which brings us to a deeper philosophical layer here, the teleology of privacy.
Right, the purpose of it.
Yes. Why is privacy structurally essential for us to even function as human beings? It isn't just about keeping secrets or avoiding embarrassment. It is a structural necessity for maintaining who we are in society.
Let's explore that. How does keeping things hidden actually allow us to function better?
Think about the role of a university professor. To function effectively in that highly specific dynamic with a student, the professor must systematically hide numerous other aspects of their life. If the student knew every single detail about the professor's private existence, their deep personal anxieties, a messy divorce they might be going through, their reckless weekend habits, it would likely collapse the authoritative mentoring identity required for that academic relationship to work.
Wait, so are you saying we're all just essentially wearing masks and lying to each other to keep society running?
Not necessarily lying, but heavily curating. We rely on selective concealment to maintain our societal roles. You cannot be a professional, a mentor, or even a good friend without carefully managing which parts of your identity are exposed in which contexts. Privacy gives you the space to simply be a specific version of yourself.
Okay, I see that. It protects the current version of you. It lets you be who you need to be in the moment. But it goes beyond just maintaining who you are today, right? Privacy is also the mechanism that allows you to become someone entirely new.
It is the incubator for change. If you want to evolve, if you want to radically shift your political beliefs, change your career path, or alter your lifestyle, you have to be able to explore those new possibilities privately. You need a safe sandbox.
Without everyone watching you stumble.
Right. Maybe that's just you alone, or maybe it's with a very small group of trusted confidants, completely free from the paralyzing observation or judgment of the broader public.
Which introduces a concept from the source material that I find deeply unsettling. Gen-humanism. And specifically, the right to discontinuity. The right to discontinuity is essentially the right to break with your past, to shed your old skin and start fresh. But becoming someone new inherently requires generating new, personally identifying information.
And herein lies the modern tragedy of this concept. We are living in an era of algorithmic permanence. Every embarrassing phase, every naive search query, every glass apartment behavior is recorded, categorized, and stored indefinitely. So I have to ask, is it still possible to truly escape who you used to be? True transformation is becoming structurally difficult because the internet never forgets your awkward phase, and more importantly, the algorithms are financially incentivized to keep reminding you of it.
That is a heavy reality to sit with. If our philosophical right to discontinuity, our right to just change our minds and grow, is under threat by permanent data tracking, how are the people building these systems responding? This brings us to the practical application in computer engineering. How do you code a human right into an algorithm?
Engineers attempt this through a framework called privacy by design. Instead of treating privacy as an afterthought or a compliance checklist you slap onto a product right before launch, privacy by design means building the preservation of user data into the tool right from the very inception of the design process.
Okay, so what does that actually look like in practice? The lecture outlined a few specific strategies.
The first and arguably most rigorous methodology is data minimization. This is a strict engineering discipline where a digital tool is built to require only the absolute minimum personal information necessary to complete an immediate task.
It's the digital equivalent of destroying the files the second the meeting is over. You order a pizza. The app obviously needs your location to deliver it, but the second that pizza hits your porch, the location data is purged.
Precisely. The system is intentionally designed to have no unnecessary vulnerabilities, because if the data does not exist in the database, it cannot be leaked in a hack, it cannot be subpoenaed, and it cannot be weaponized against the user later on.
But let's be real here. We live in an AI boom. Researchers and tech giants are ravenous for data. They claim they absolutely need vast historical data sets to train their models and do broad societal research. Minimization doesn't really work for them, does it?
It doesn't, which is why engineers developed a second strategy, differential privacy. This is a highly sophisticated statistical method of anonymization. Let's walk through a simplified mathematical example from the source to see how it functions. Imagine a medical data set of 100 people. Exactly 50 are men and 50 are women.
Okay, a perfect split.
Right. Now, engineers can deploy an algorithm that intentionally jumbles the data. It randomly swaps the documented genders of the individuals within the data set, but it is programmed to rigorously maintain that exact 50-50 overall proportion.
Wait, but if you're statistically jumbling everyone's gender or medical history, doesn't that make the data completely useless? If I'm a researcher trying to find out if a specific man has a specific health risk, you've just scrambled the reality of the situation.
That is the massive trade-off, and you've hit on the core academic caveat of differential privacy. It preserves the macro-level value of the data. If a sociologist just needs to know the broad trends of a population, say, overall voting patterns or general disease spread, the 50-50 proportion is maintained, so the big picture remains accurate. Meanwhile, it is mathematically impossible to trace a specific data point back to an individual user's real identity.
Because even if a hacker breaches the database, they have no idea if the person listed as male was actually male, or if they were flipped by the algorithm.
Exactly. But to your point, if an engineer or doctor is running a highly granular, micro-level study that is heavily dependent on precise individual data points, this statistical jumbling will completely ruin the result. It is an incredibly elegant tool, but it is highly context-dependent.
Okay, so minimization deletes the data, and differential privacy scrambles the identities inside the database. But what if you can't do either? What if the platform refuses to minimize and you still want to fight back against the surveillance directly from your end?
That is where engineers take the complete opposite approach, obfuscation. Instead of hiding your data or limiting what you share, obfuscation conceals your personal information by generating an overwhelming avalanche of fake data. It is the ultimate digital smokescreen.
I love this concept so much. The workshop provided a real-world example of this. An add-on you can install for the Firefox web browser called TrackMeNot. As you are browsing the internet normally, reading the news, or buying shoes, this add-on is silently working in the background, aggressively surfing to completely random web pages and submitting fake search queries.
It's essentially letting a digital toddler loose on your keyboard while you try to get actual work done.
Yes. And the brilliance of it is how it affects the observer. If your internet service provider is actively monitoring your traffic, they don't just see you searching for a local doctor. They see you searching for a doctor mixed with a deep dive into 14th century monarchs, followed by an inquiry into the price of industrial farming equipment in Belarus.
Yeah.
Your genuine digital footprint is rendered entirely worthless, completely lost in a sea of statistically identical noise.
It is privacy through oversaturation. They have all your data, but they have no earthly idea what is real human behavior and what is just the machine talking to itself. It fundamentally devalues the surveillance apparatus by making the signal-to-noise ratio impossible to parse.
But as clever as obfuscation is, it still feels like a band-aid. We're still playing defense in our glass apartments.
Mm.
Which brings us to a completely different angle the lecture covers. Data ownership.
Right, shifting from defense to economics.
Exactly. The logic here is born out of pure frustration. If it's practically impossible to stop platforms from looking into our glass apartments and harvesting our data, shouldn't we explicitly monetize it? If they are building trillion-dollar empires off our personal behaviors, shouldn't you and I get a monthly dividend check?
It is a very appealing principle. But when this is debated in academic and legal circles, you immediately run into the platform rebuttal. The tech companies argue that a single person's isolated data is virtually worthless on its own. Your individual profile, your specific likes, your location history might amount to just fractions of a penny in a broader algorithmic marketplace.
Because the value is in the volume.
Exactly. They argue that the value only emerges in the aggregate when millions of profiles are combined. Therefore, setting up an administrative and economic system to pay you for your individual contribution is mathematically and economically unviable.
Unviable for them, maybe, because it hurts their profit margins. But philosophers don't let that stop the thought experiment. If we can force an ownership system, how would we structure it? There are two competing economic models of the self that get debated here. The first is the Lockean model, named after philosopher John Locke.
The Lockean model treats personal information as simple, transferable property. Think of it like selling an apple at a farmer's market. You grew the data, you sell it to a tech platform, you receive a flat payment, and the transaction is absolute and final. You no longer own that data. The company can do whatever they want with it forever.
Which feels a little dystopian. I don't want to permanently sell my biometric data or my political history like it's a piece of fruit. That brings us to the alternative framework, the ART model. This model argues that personal information isn't a detached commodity. It is an intrinsic, permanent extension of your physical and psychological self.
Right. Under the art model, you cannot permanently sell your data, much in the same way a novelist retains ultimate moral rights to their book, even after a publisher buys the manuscript to print it. In this framework, you can only rent your data out.
So what does renting actually look like in a digital economy?
It would likely involve smart contracts. You grant a company temporary access to analyze your browsing habits for a specific ad campaign. You maintain ultimate overriding ownership, and you receive ongoing royalties or compensation for that temporary access. And then, crucially, once the contract expires, their right to use your data evaporates.
It sounds like a perfect solution. It really does.
No.
But implementing either of these models runs into a massive logistical brick wall today. A lot of advocates suggest using blockchain technology to manage this, creating a decentralized ledger where you cryptographically gatekeep access to your personal data and track exactly who is renting it.
But a limitation there is brutally economic. Think about the sheer computational cost, the server power, the electricity, and the processing required to create, verify, and maintain a global blockchain ledger for every single individual's microdata transactions is astronomical.
Right. If my individual data profile is only worth a few pennies a month to an advertiser, but it costs $3 in computing power and electricity to secure the smart contract on the blockchain, the mask just doesn't work.
Exactly. You would be spending dollars in computational power to secure fractions of a cent in data value. So while data ownership is a fascinating theoretical framework, it is currently vastly less practical than the proactive privacy by design engineering strategies we discussed earlier.
Which brings this entire exploration to its absolute peak. We have mapped the feeling of privacy, the philosophy of agency, the algorithmic engineering, and the economics. But to truly test the validity of any human value, you have to push it to its breaking point. We have to look at an ultimate ethical clash. A scenario where your definitive right to privacy violently collides with the collective good of society.
We can look at a profound recent case study from the source material to illustrate this, the dilemma surrounding highly contagious viruses, like what we saw with COVID-19.
And to be clear to the listener, we are looking at this strictly as an ethical data dilemma, impartially examining the philosophical framework, completely removed from any political debate.
Absolutely. Biologically speaking, being infected with a highly transmissible pathogen is deeply personal, identifying information. It is data about the internal state of your physical body.
And under a strict, uncompromising model of privacy, where you have ultimate control over your data, that medical information belongs solely to you. You are the architect of that boundary.
However, the opposing ethical argument is incredibly heavy. If your personal illness poses a direct transmissible physical threat that could sicken, permanently injure, or kill other people in your vicinity, does the collective society suddenly acquire an overriding ownership claim over your personal data?
Right. Does the fact that you are a biological vector for disease mean the community has a right to smash the walls of your glass apartment to see what's inside?
That is the fierce debate. Many ethicists argue no. Society has no right to that information without explicit consent, and individual privacy remains sacrosanct regardless of the external threat. Their argument is that if you breach it for a virus, the precedent is set to breach it for anything.
While others argue that collective survival fundamentally mandates a surrender of that specific personal data.
Exactly. It forces us to ask how resilient our individual rights really are, when placed in a broader, fragile social ecosystem.
And that tension is exactly what we want to leave you with today. We've seen how privacy is defined by philosophers, how it's scrambled by engineers, and how it's valued by economists. But when the stakes escalate to life and death, the algorithms and the smart contracts fall away, leaving only a raw human conflict. If you truly own your data, at what exact point does your absolute right to privacy evaporate in the face of social well-being?
And if that line exists, who gets the authority to draw it?
Exactly. And to push that even further for you to mull over, as we move toward a future of embedded biometric sensors, ambient computing, and smart cities that track your temperature and heart rate just by walking down the street, it makes you wonder, will the very concept of the glass apartment become entirely obsolete? Because in a world built entirely out of sensors, there won't be any walls left to begin with. That is a future you will have to grapple with long after this deep dive ends.